Good afternoon. So last time we built up from our basic components to build less simple CPUs. Talked a lot about our general strategy of connecting our components, and whenever we had a conflict where one instruction wanted to do one thing, wanted to do something else for a different instruction, we added a mux to make that decision. That's our general pattern. Then we started talking about, well, we have these nice pictures of what our processors look like, these boxes of logic. We want to make that both more formal, get to something closer to something we could actually compile down to a description that someone could build directly, and something that might be easier to manage. So we had our text-based description of circuits using our HCL language. We learned that in this class we'll use a variant that's not the same as our textbooks, which hopefully is generally more flexible and easier than what our textbook started with. And we'll use that to build processors, in particular build y86 processors, because our toolchain is sort of built just for that, like the same sort of concept supply that would apply over our general tool, but it's specialized for our assignments. So a note about this code here, and I believe this is where we left off. So this is an implementation of this NOP and jump CPU. So we have our plus one, PC plus one for a NOP. For jump, we take our destination from the instruction, and we make a decision based on the I code of the instruction, the top 4 bits of the first byte, which is bits 4 through 8, to do it. One thing I'm taking advantage of here is that in HCL, we can define these wires, which are hold values with a name rather than writing a value over and over again. So for example, I say I code is a 4-bit value. That's what this declaration up here says. And I say that value is i10 bytes, bits 4 through 8. And then I use that here and here and here and here and here, rather than typing i10 bytes 4.8 over and over again. And I do the same with dest. I say dest is bits 8 through 72, and then I worry later on about whether that's actually going to be used later on, and I can put all my splitting the instruction together. That's sort of an organizational choice I made, so on. And we also mentioned that we need to set a default value for our muxes. Here I have this conspicuous hexadecimal value. I've chosen that. So when I look at the output of my processor and I find out, hey, why are we executing instructions at this address bad, bad, bad? I'll be like, oh, it's probably this default case in my mux. Whereas if I put a 0 there, I'd say, why are we executing instructions at address 0? Well, lots of things could be happening. So that's just there to help me debug, because I assume that shouldn't happen. I believe when we left off, we showed that we can take this code and we can run it. So here I have my, basically, copy of that CPU. And I can run glrs with on some file that I've assembled earlier. Remember our assembly, our binary image files, we have the readable part and we have the part that's actually loaded into memory as a list of bytes. So I take my NOP jump CPU and run it on that. And I get this trace of instructions. And I can go through this step by step and see that. Look at every instruction. So you might say, well, scrolling is awfully inconvenient. So we can redirect the output to a file like this. Handy thing you can do for any program, just doing it for this one. And I can view that in a text editor, let's say, and read what happens and carefully figure out, okay, we have a NOP followed by a jump to address 13. So on, and if we were changing registers in memory, I could look in each cycle what those values are and figure out whether the right things were happening. So there's some other features that are useful here that we might want to take advantage of. And one of those is that if we look at the help option to HTTPS, we have a debug option and an interactive option. Let's look at the debug option. So I'm going to run a program with the debug option, which I can also write dash D. And we get a lot of output, so I'll redirect it to a file again, just so I don't scroll. And we can see here that we have some extra output. So when I use the instruction memory, it tells me this is what it was set to based on this value, in addition to showing me the disassembled value. And also, I have this table of the value of all my wires, which is the name we'll have for any signal. We call them wires, even though they're mostly wire bundles because they're multiple bits. That's the name we use for all the signals. So I have all these values in alphabetical order after every single cycle. So this is something you can use to help debug. So it shows you what happened every time. So if you're confused about why did something end up that way, you have values to kind of trace what happened looking at your HCL code. Note that when we show the value being loaded from instruction memory, we show the whole value. So here I have one jump instruction in part of the next because we load 10 bytes. So another option that exists is there's a dash interactive or dash I option. And what that does, if you run it on an actual program, is it asks you after every cycle to press enter. So you can think of this as single step. I can go one at a time, just advance when I want to. And you can combine this with the debug option if you find that easier than redirecting the output to a file and looking at that. And just press enter, go to the next cycle, and so on. So any questions on these options? Yes.
This may be a really stupid question, but does that look like dash DI or dash D dash I?
The question is that dash D, I wrote dash D dash I, that dash I. If you write dash DI, it also works.
Okay.
Okay, other questions? Okay, so that's debugging and so on. All right, there's also a quiet mode. So if you run with dash Q, it skips all the way to the end. So this is the final state. And this is handy if you just want to know, well, did the registers in memory get set correctly by something when you're changing registers in memory? It also shows you the final value of the PC register, which is maybe a bug, because I didn't handle the halt instruction in my mux. Though it doesn't really matter what the PC is when we're halted. So this just shows you the final state. So it suppresses a lot of output. So you can use that if you just don't like reading tons of output. Okay. So that's sort of the basics of HCL. And I'd like to point out some like the big differences from what the book does. So our biggest difference is this notion is that how signals are declared. So we could call all our signals wires. Our book has bools and ints. We just call them all wires, and we specify their widths. That's how we distinguish between them. We don't have separate names. The book has a particular naming convention, and in the book's HCL, a lot of these names were required. They were kind of half built in and weren't very flexible. We're a bit more flexible that way. And the book just has a weird naming convention, which I'm going to use generally here because I want to be consistent with the book. Not that I think the book has made good choices. Notably, the book has vowel A, B, C, E, M, and P. And the book's convention is vowel. These are all 64-bit values. Related to something. So we also have some other differences. All our muxes need a default case, which is just a rule because we think it's less error prone. And we don't have some built-in components that the textbook's environment has. So in the textbook's environment, the ALU and the condition code handling were given in sort of a built-in component like our instruction memory. We are going to have you build that because you have muxes, you can do it. You have registers too, so you can do it. Okay. So let's talk about HCLS features, including reviewing some ones we talked about last time, being a little more systematic, and talking about the general case, and also talking about the other components we know exist, but we haven't used yet. So the register file, we know there's a register file because we've seen the output includes register names all the time, and their values, and we know there's a data memory. Somehow, there's some way of writing to memory, so we can see that. Let's talk first about register banks. So a register bank is a set of register declarations. We've only seen one for the PC. You can in fact have as many as you like with different names. We have input signals named after the first letter, which is always lowercase, of the register bank name. Outputs named after the last. And each register has a width and a default value. Both are mandatory. There's also some other signals we'll talk about later associated with register banks for helping implement pipelining, namely stall and bool, which we'll talk about later in the semester. So we have the width in bits and the initial value. Otherwise, we have the input and output signals. So questions on register banks? Yeah. So the input signal is the value to store that will be output next cycle. So for the PC register, it's the next PC in the next cycle. And the output is the current value. And when we've drawn registers, we've said that this is our output, and this is our input, and they wait till the rising edge of the clock, the next clock cycle, to copy the input and start outputting it. Okay, other questions?
So foo and bar would be considered separate registers, right?
So the question is, foo and bar are separate registers? Yes. Right now, we don't have a reason to have more than one register. We'll soon have some. A reason to have a lot of registers. Yeah?
Do we have to declare our registers like this? Or could we have like multiple register banks or like one bank and a couple of registers?
The question is, do you have to declare them all together like this? You can have as many, you can have multiple register banks, but you should only have one with each particular name. Yes.
Do we need to declare the registers that are built in? So besides the PC, like, do we want to use the RA?
So the question is about the registers in the register file, and the answer is no, and we'll talk about what that looks like when we talk about how the register file works. Okay. Let's also talk about wires. So we saw declaring wires as this sort of shorthand. So we can declare a wire name with a width. The width is mandatory, and we can assign something to the wire, and we can use the wire multiple times. Assignment is not like assignment in C. You can think of it as connecting the signal or not. Like if we had a circuit diagram, there's a connection, that's what it means in the direction of the assignment. In particular, the big thing which is going to be different is that the order is not going to matter. We'll talk about that next. Something to note about wires is that you can explicitly declare wires, but we'll call any signal a wire, including the built-in signal. So for example, PC, the input to the instruction memory is a wire. And the X foo, Y bar, those output and input and output signals of the register banks were wires. So order doesn't matter for wire assignments. So the way things work is that we get our initial values, like the values of registers, and we figure out where they're used, we propagate that, and we keep going. We don't care about where the code for that is. We're going to do it in whatever order we have to do to get the values until we figure out what happens for the whole cycle. So here, we're going to find out, oh, the PC initially starts at 0, so I'm going to use 0 here. I set PC to 0. That means I'm going to set i10 bytes to something. I'm going to use that here. I'm going to use that value in here, even though this is out of order. And that means that this and this are equivalent, even though, for example, here, I assign from valp, which is assigned up here, which is set down here, and here I assign in the other order. That doesn't matter. The exact same effect will happen. It's not processed in order. It's processed that we do everything every cycle. And we just do thing. We just look for, I need valp, I'm going to find it. And we just do that until we resolve everything. And if you don't have an assignment for a value, it's an error. Yes?
So does order not matter for anything?
The question is, does order not matter for anything? The answer is no, because it matters for these. It matters for boxes.
Chunk, right?
What?
The box is one chunk.
Yes, so the order doesn't matter for the assignment lines and the register banks, yeah. It does matter within a line, like for muxes.
Do we need to declare the wire before we assign it to things?
Do we need to declare it before we assign it? I don't actually remember. I recommend doing so. I think it's required, but I'm not sure. I always do it, so I don't notice. Okay, so order doesn't matter. One way of thinking about this is because we're representing circuits, it's either connected to something or it isn't. It doesn't matter when you connect it, it's connected or it's not. So another thing about wires is we saw that they had widths, and all our named signals are going to have, that aren't constants, are going to have widths. And when you assign values, they need to agree in width. If you don't, you'll get an error. So if I take a 32-bit value and try to put it on a 64-bit wire, really a wire bundle, I'm going to get an error. We're not going to just add zeros. It's an error. You can't do that. You need to be explicit if you want to do some conversion which adds zeros. And if I take a 64-bit value and try to put it in the 32-bit one, we're not just going to truncate it. We're going to give you an error, a compile time error. Hey, you can't do that. Boom. So if you want to do that sort of thing, you can use subsetting. There is a concatenate two wire values together to make a bigger one operator, though I've never seen anyone use it ever. Any questions on width? So wire values have width. So something where the width is not so obvious is what happens when I do, you know, something like, you know, an assignment of a constant, which is a valid thing. So constants have special rules for widths. So decimal and hexadecimal constants don't have a width. They will convert to whatever width you want them to, even if this doesn't make sense. For example, you can assign a 10-bit, you know, the number 10 to a 1-bit wire, and it probably won't do what you expect, but it's not wrong. It's allowed. Binary constants, which are specified with 0b, do have a width, and that's the width that they're specified with. And all the built-in constants, therefore, have widths. So you can think of this as sort of, it's a very primitive form of error checking. In that, when you have, say, the constant we have here for the NOP instruction opcode, which is 4 bits, if you try to compare that to something where it doesn't make sense, like you try to say PC equals NOP, you'll get an error because that's not how, you know, PC is an address, not an iCode value, which we don't actually know that, but we know that iCode values are 4 bits, addresses are 64. On the other hand, if you like try to assign a 64-bit value to a 64-bit address, well, they're the same type in the sense of that they're the same width. You're not going to get an error about that, but it will detect some problems. And all the built-in constants for that reason have widths to help you avoid obvious errors like using an iCode value as a 64-bit value. Yes?
When we convert to a different width, if it's a constant that doesn't have width, how does it do that?
How does it do that? It just takes the lower bits.
So it truncates or zero extends?
It truncates, yeah. Zero extends internally. Internally, the constants are represented as 128-bit values. 128-bit, yeah, values, which are usually unsigned. And we just truncate that. So then we have our built-in components, and we've seen the first two. So the stat register, which remember tells whether we keep going, and the instruction memory, which is where we read our program from, and which we remember we had to use or else things wouldn't work, even if we didn't really care what the instructions were. So the stat, we have these special constants, which are just multi-bit values. So AOK for keep going, halt is our stop. We have INS for invalid instruction, and if you go to on our website, that page I pulled up earlier is the HCRS tab at the top of our course website. You can look there to see all the other possible constants. Basically, everything which is not AOK or halt is going to be some sort of error message that stops the processor. So it must be set, and it determines if the simulator keeps going based in the next cycle. We also had our instruction memory. So we, for our instruction memory, we have our 64-bit wire PC, which is the address to read from, and we have a 10-byte output, 80 bits, i10 bytes. And we talked last time about the bit order within that as far as why bits 4 through 8 were the high order bits of the first byte, where we find out what line of our Y86 machine code table we're in. Okay, and you have to read 10 bytes. If you don't have a 10-byte instruction, just don't use all of the 10 bits. And that's perfectly fine. So then we have our register file. So we have a built-in register file. You don't have to build it out of the register banks, even though that is technically feasible. Just would be really annoying. Lots of code with like muxes with 15 cases. So we have signals that all correspond to the inputs we've seen on our pictures of register files. So we have our two read ports and our two write ports. In the sense, for register files and memories, when we say a read port, we mean something where you can read one value, and a write port is something where you can write one value. So our register file, like the textbooks, lets you read two values and write two values at a time. So for reading values, we have to be able to specify which register to read from. So we have a 4-bit inputs for that. Source A and source B, named reg underscore source A, reg underscore source B. And we have, for writing, two destinations, reg dest M and reg dest D. Don't bother memorizing these. You can look them up on that page at the top of the course website if you forget what the signals are. You shouldn't need to actually have them memorized. And like the register file we mentioned before, we pass the register number 15 to mean not writing or reading anything, which there's a constant regenun for. to go along with our register numbers to read, our 4-bit numbers to read, we get output from the register file, read output A and output B, which are the values of those registers. The general convention we have for these built-in components is that the signals are named from the perspective of the component. So reg output is the output of the register file. It's your input, the register file's output. Reg input is the input to the register file. So we have also reg dest m paired with reg input m for writing. And like the register file we discussed, for reads, it happens during the cycle. So you put a value on reg source A, and in the same cycle, reg output A will contain the value you want to compute. So that's ready by the end of the clock cycle. And inputs will only change register values at the rising edge of the clock. So the changes will only show up in the next clock cycle. Okay, so questions? Yes? So given this, we can construct our register file using CPU. Here is just a CPU which does add. So we have our PC increment, PC plus 2 for our add instructions, which if you remember, we have, I believe, a 6, the I code, the function code, and then RA and RB. So we extract RA and RB. And we read from those registers using the register numbers from the instruction. And when we read, we get the values of those registers, the 64-bit values in the same cycle, and reg output A and output B, which we add together and use as input to our register file. And we write into register B at the end of the clock cycle. Questions? What you see here. Another thing that comes up here is that because RA is the most significant bit of the second bits of the second byte, it's 12 through 16 and not 8 through 12. Any questions? So we can sort of think of this as being drawn out here. We have reg source A comes from RA, reg source B comes from RB. We have our values from the register file, which we've commonly represented as the registers as an array R. Some common notation we'll see a bunch. And we add those together and send them into the input of the next value. We have a register number to write that value to, which comes from RB. Yeah?
So if there's no wire hooked up to it, we don't need to explicitly send F into...
So the question is, what's happening with dest M? Yes, so that as a special rule, if you don't set any of the signals, they default to a sensible thing, which is going to be regnum for the register file signals. And this is why we could get away with, in all our previous code, not ever touching these reg underscore values at all. Yes?
Why are there two different write ports? Like, when are you going to be able to write the same?
The question is, why are there two write ports? The reason our textbook chose to do that is for the pop instruction. So if you think of pop RAX, it changes RAX plus RSP. Other questions? So then we have our data memory. So the data memory has the same signals we saw before. We just have to have particular names for them. So we have the address the data memory is acting on. Remember, the data memory can either read or write. We have one address input for both cases, called mem adder. We have an input value. Again, this is named from the perspective of the data memory. So mem input is the input to the data memory, what the data memory thinks is its input. We have its output value. So the input value is only if writing, and the output value is only if reading. And we have our enable signals. So memReadBit is the read enable signal, memWriteBit is the write enable signal, which control which operation we do. So for reading, we set memAdder, and in the same cycle, memOutput will contain the value in memory at that address, assuming we enable reading. And for writing, assuming we enable writing, we set the address and the input. And at the in the next cycle, if we try to read from that memory location, it will have been changed based on the input. And this can come up because we can write to a memory location with a data memory while we're reading from it with the instruction memory. And it's all one memory put together. So the data instruction memory magically accesses this one unified memory, which we haven't talked about how that could possibly work in hardware, but that's what we're assuming for now. Yeah?
For read and write, like, if one of them is 0, the other one has to be 1.
The question is, for read and write, if one of them is 0, the other one has to be 1. This is what I strongly recommend doing, but we do not actually enforce this. You can definitely set them both to 0. Setting them both to 1, I don't recommend doing.
It'll just read first, right?
It should read first and then also write, but it's not actually useful for anything you want to do. So it's almost certainly an error. So those are our built-in components. So we're missing some built-in components that the textbook has. So one is that the textbook sort of has a built-in ALU. We don't need it because you can implement that yourself. You have muxes, and you have all the arithmetic expressions, so you can do what their ALU does by yourself. And that's what we're going to assume you'll do. And you might use it, have it work a bit differently. Like, they have like an ALU op they need to set because they have a built-in component that works something like this, where it takes an ALU op and does the operation based on that. You can have it be based on the iCode or something like that instead, and that's fine. So generally, we're going to test you on functionality and taking the correct amount of time. So if we ask you to make a single cycle processor, we expect you to execute the instructions correctly, one cycle per instruction, not something else. And you have a bunch of choices that the textbook makes that you do not need to make. So for example, the textbook has chosen that memory, when memory, a value is being read from memory and written to a register, it always goes to the M port of the register file. They've also chosen that RSP plus or minus 8 use the single norm ALU. These are, and there's a bunch of other choices like that that they've made that you don't need to make. If you want to have things work differently, if you want to use the ePort all the time you can absolutely do that. As long as you take a single cycle per instruction, except when we tell you to implement a different kind of processor, and use the supply register file in memory, so we can actually figure out what effect these instructions have, then it's fine. And this also applies to like naming. You don't have to ever use the name valp. If you don't like that name, you can use some other name, and it's fine. So any questions about this? And this comes up with, we're going to have you start implementing Y86 stuff in lab this week with the homework due next week just before the midterm. So one last thing about thinking about things our textbook has is we have a reference implementation from our textbook authors in the tools directory that comes with HCLRS. We had YAS in here. There's also a YIS, which is an interpreter for Y86. So you can use it to figure out what should a Y86 program do. So for example, I have my knob jump CPU here, and I had my knob jump.o, and I found out that it halted after 7 cycles. I can run tools YIS on the same .yo file and find out it halts after 7 cycles at a particular PC address with particular values for the condition codes. And also there were no changes to registers or memory. So this lets me know, I can use this to check what should have the assembly done with this reference implementation. And I can use this to figure out what assembly does if I don't want to bother figuring out by hand or don't trust that I did that correctly. So if we take a more complicated assembly file, like, say something that involves the push instruction, I stop with invalid instruction. If I run this on tools YIS, it tells me what it should have done. That should have changed RDX from 0 to 100 hex and so on. So this is something you can use, especially if you write your own test cases so you know what was supposed to happen and see if your processor is doing something weird. Okay, so that's everything on HCL. So HCL, the general structure is we have these wires. Some of the wires are things you declare. Some of them are things that are for built-in components. Some of them are implied by like declaring a register bank. But everything is these wires, which are these actually wire bundles of some number of bits that you do assignments in between, which are connecting things together. So the order doesn't matter. It's just, is it connected or not? You can have muxes where on any assignment to a wire with our mux syntax, which is if, else if, and so on. Just apply the test in order. You can define your own register banks. Right now, the only important one is going to be the PC. Later on, we'll have reasons for more. And we have a bunch of what we call fixed functionality, these built-in components, like our register file, our memories, and our stat register, that have these built-in signals with particular names. And we showed you what the names were in these slides. You can look them up on the web page. If you ever forget them, we don't expect you to memorize all the names. It's not like something that's worth your time. Okay, so any questions? Let's go back to a topic we had talked about earlier, which is stages. And we can see that stages show up in HCL. If I label this actually the way it should be, that if you go by our textbook stages, they say that all this is the fetch stage, that this part here where we're reading registers is the code, that this is the execute stage of our add where we do the ALU operation of adding. Then we have our write back. There's no memory stage because we don't do anything with the data memory. And we have our PC update. And so looking at how this works with HCL, we can see like why we want to organize things this way is that, well, we can write each of these chunks of code separately, just thinking about what happens in the stage. And our textbook has chosen a convention about we're going to pass things between stages with, for example, valp. That's why they have this valp, because they're passing values from one stage to the other. So you can write each piece of code independently. So this is part of the idea of why our textbook talks about using stages, is that you can just look at what happens in each stage, write the code based on that, and deal with each stage independently. And in fact, you can do this for multiple instructions. And our textbook has these tables where they show you what instructions do in a way which has this sort of very direct correspondence to HCL code. They have a bit of funny notation, so I'm going to go over that just because it's not obvious how to read it. So one thing they write is they write this M underscore 1. And that means a value from memory that is 1 byte. So they're saying read 1 byte from memory at the address in the PC, by which they mean the out value being output from the PC register. So this means that we're taking part of the output wires of the instruction memory, and we're giving it names iCode and iFun. So this is equivalent to our iCode equals i10 bytes. Remember, the output of the instruction memory of 4.8, and iFun is i10 bytes of 0.4. And we also have an assignment of val p is pc plus 1, which was equivalent to our, we saw val p equals the PC register's output plus 1. And then we have this assignment to PC. And this is not an assignment to the PC signal, because remember, the PC signal in HCL is actually the instruction memory input. This is an assignment to the PC register, by which we mean not actually changing the PC register, but setting its input wire so at the next clock cycle it will change. So this is equivalent to little p underscore the PC, if we've named the register that way, equals val p, assigning the input of the register to that value. Okay, questions? Yes? So the question is, why do we create a whole new variable just to update PC? We will have a good reason to do this when we talk about pipelining, where we're going to want to be very careful about how we send values between stages. And so to prepare for that, the textbook authors have decided that we're going to make these temporary values whenever we pass things between stages. And you can see this for multiple instructions. So here I have nop and jump as these stages. And in some cases, we're going to end up with some conflicts. So here, I have two values I want to be the input to the PC. And whenever we see that, we need a mux, and we need all the logic we have for deciding what is the actual input to this mux. And you can see how this corresponds to the processor we showed earlier. So by having those conflicting stage definitions, we're saying you need this mux. And the textbook has chosen slightly different names for these signals. What I labeled opcode, they call iCode. What I labeled, didn't label at all, which is the nop size plus 1, is val p. What I call des, they call val c. And they just called the input to the PC register PC. So something to note about this is that they don't show this explicitly. Now, this is a property of separating things into stages. They're not actually listing this logic, which we'll learn is called control logic. Yeah. They're not showing that explicitly. That's implied by different things happen for different instructions. So let's go through some other examples of things where we need to have this notation. So another thing that they show is reading from registers. So this assignment here is using element RA of the array R that's reading from register number RA. So it's setting the register number input like reg source A, reg source B, and naming the output wires. Notice that we have a disagreement here between what these two instructions do to the register file. So maybe we need a mux, or maybe we don't, depending on whether you think you care about reading registers you aren't using. We also have assignments to memory. And in the memory stage, that means they use the data memory. So here, this says set 8 bytes at address val e to val a, which means set the address input of the memory to val e, set the value input, mem input, to val A, set write enable to 1 to make the write happen, and the other way around, here we set read enable and set the address input again to value. We also have writing to registers. And like with our PC write, this is setting the input to the register file so it will happen at the rising edge of the clock. Like it doesn't actually do the write right away. And this says the input value is valm and the register number is RA. So questions on any of this notation here? Yes. Is there an efficiency difference between reading additional register versus putting in a mux to decide not to? Probably not. It depends. I don't think it's significant. I don't think it comes up on quote unquote real processors because they have a very different way of managing the register file that we might talk about later in the semester. Okay, other questions? Okay, so there's our, this corresponds all to our move CPU. So you see we have our different names for things. So they called something val A and val B, the outputs of the register file. They called the immediate val C for, if you look at the description they have for IRMOVEQ, they call that val C. They call the output of the data memory val M, the output of the ALU val E, but other than different names, it's exactly this picture. Something like what we saw before that doesn't happen is that all this stuff related to the opcode isn't shown explicitly. And this is what we'll call the control path. So often people will talk about the data path of a processor versus the control path of a processor. So the data path is basically everything I didn't highlight here, which is where the actual data goes. And the control path is what controls the muxes and so on that decide when we have multiple places for the data to go, which one do we actually use. And this is not like a 100% clear distinction. For example, are condition codes part of the control path? Well, they're used to make control decisions. They're like conditional stuff. But they're part of the program state. There's something we save when we want to, stop the program for debugging, for example. In order to like step to the next instruction, we need to know what the condition codes are. So it's not a clear line. But generally, this is going to come up because very often, I and other people who describe processors are going to omit the control path or parts of the control path from any drawings and other descriptions of the processor. They're just going to leave it implied that we figure out how to make all that stuff work. And the important part of the processor they're going to describe is the data path. And there's going to be a mux there or something like that you're going to have to figure out how does that actually get set. Okay, so questions on concept of control path. Okay, so we have our various stages. So let's just step through systematically what happens with each of them, which is another way of thinking about our processor. So we have our instruction fetch stage, which in our textbook, contrary to the name, splits out the instruction into pieces after fetching it, and also computes the next instruction address, where by next instruction I mean the one that's on the next line of assembly, which might not be the next instruction we run, for example, if it's a jump. So in our picture, this corresponds roughly to setting up something like this. We have val p, which is our next instruction address. We have val c, which is the immediate from an instruction if we have one. And we have our register numbers. And we also have the iCode and iFun, but I'm not drawing those because those are part of the control path. Then our decode stage, contrary to its name, is where we read registers. So this is where we produce RA and RB. And you might say, okay, so this is what we're going to do, right? We're going to say, we read our A from one of the register files and read our B from the other. Because that's like the worst case is we have to read two registers, like for add, or RM move Q. And we want to read exactly our A and our B. Is there any problems with this? Any instructions I don't handle? The ones where you read memory. So what instructions are they? Yeah, so we still have an execute stage where we figure out the value we're reading from, but we're not going to read from the register file to read memory. But what instructions were you thinking of in particular?
Like MR move Q.
Okay, so for MR move Q, we are going to read from DRB into RA. So the question is, do we have a problem here? Well, we don't actually care about this value. But as long as we don't use it, it's OK. But maybe it would be better not to read it. So I could see the case for saying, OK, we don't care about this value, so we shouldn't really have a mux here to put in reg none, register 15. I could see that case. So maybe that's something we want to do for like that instruction, like for NOP and so on. There's something which is a bigger issue, which is related to instructions that access memory. Push and pop. So what do we want to do for push and pop?
I'm not totally sure. I need someone else to take over.
Okay. What does push and pop do, ignoring this picture? Yeah.
Doesn't it write to two registers?
So pop writes to two registers, yes. That doesn't come up yet because I haven't connected anything to destination M&E and presumably will for write back.
We're reading from memory and then writing to memory.
Okay,
I don't know what I'm saying.
For a push and pop instruction, you're going to decrement and increment the stack pointer and move whatever is pointed to at the stack pointer. In the case of a push, you're going to take the register's value. You're going to decrement the stack pointer and then put that value where the stack pointer is pointing.
Okay.
And then in a pop, you're going to get the value from the stack pointer, put it in the register you specify, and then increment the stack pointer.
Yeah. So we're going to do stuff based on the stack pointer. So where is the stack pointer on this picture? Isn't it in our register file? Yes. It's in our register file. How do we get it?
We just define like source A to be RSB or source B to be RSB.
Yes, we get it by sending in its register number into source A or source B.
Oh, so we need a mux to do that. So,
and we aren't doing that yet. Okay. So that is something we need a mux for, is that we need some way. We're not planning to include these instructions, but our textbook needs to do this. We need some way to read and write RSP, to read RSP for push and pop and call and return. So we're going to have a mux to handle that case. And a way you could figure this out is you can make a table. You can just go through all the instructions and figure out what should source A and source B be. Like, what registers do I want to read? I've made an arbitrary assignment of the registers to source A and source B. Well, not arbitrary, based on the textbook, but like you could do a different one. But if you make a table like this, you can figure out what to do. And we see we have some cases where I want an RSP. Also, like I wrote none, we could say, oh, it's OK to read from RB or RA in the case where I have none. Or we could say, I want to explicitly read none. Like either is correct to do. Okay. So questions? So that's where we got sort of our minimal set, looks something like that. Then we have execute. And the execute, our textbook, we reduce our ALU output, which is val E. We also read the condition codes. So our textbook has a signal they call CND. So their implementation of HCL had this functionality built in where based on the current function code, like less than, equal, or so on, it would compute the condition code results into cons. You have to do that yourself. But this is the stage where a textbook does everything with condition codes. You might say, that doesn't make much sense. Like, don't we actually care about this like in write back for conditional move, where we decide whether to write the value or not, and in PC update for conditional jumps? And that's a reasonable thing to say. We have a very good reason, I promise, when we talk about pipelining, why we're doing it in the execute stage. While we're reading condition codes in the execute stage. While we're writing them in the execute stage, well, that's because that's where we're doing the ALU operation, where we figure out what might change in the condition codes. Yeah. Okay. So you might say, well, if we don't have the textbook figuring out how, you know, having their own implementation of the condition codes, how do we do it? Well, you have MUXes. So basically what we're doing is like we figure out, do we have a jump less than, or in this case, do we have a conditional move less than, a conditional move less, and we use that to control, say, whether we write to a register or not. You just have a big MUX for all the possible types of conditional move instructions, and the same thing for jumps. So, with that in mind, here's my simple execute stage. We add two values together. Let's say the two values we get from register, that's the add instruction, the most obvious use of the ALU. Again, there are going to be some cases where this is not going to be good enough. So which ones of these are we in trouble? Did I make a mistake by wiring up the ALU that way? So back there. So MR move queue. What's wrong with MR move queue in this setup?
It's adding source B, which should be adding value C.
Yeah, so MR move queue, we have D of RA or RB. We should be adding the displacement for move. So that needs to end up as an ALU input. So it's D plus RB, it turns out. Okay, any of the other instructions have a problem? So MR move Q, we said, was one. Any others? Yeah.
For pop,
okay.
We want to subtract one from
Yeah, so for pop, we want to do adjust the stack pointer, and the same thing for call. So we have our exception for MR move queue, so we need some way of getting the value from the instruction, the displacement, and we have these constants, plus or minus 8, we need to do for our stack instructions. So we have a few extra cases we need. So I end up with something like this. So just an extra MUX there. Okay. So then we have our memory stage, where we read or write data memory. And in our text notation, they mostly don't talk about the signals, input signals explicitly. They just say we read from this address. But they have named valm as the name of the signal that we get from reading memory, if we're reading memory. So what does this look like? You know, well, something like this. So if we think about our MR move queue, we learned, I forgot to draw a wire, that we do D of RB into RA, and RM move queue ends up being RA into D of RB. So this is, seems fine for MR move Q and RM move Q. So that seems okay. How about the other instructions? on that list. So we're gonna have problems. So what are they? So. Yeah.
I don't know if this is what you're looking for, but for all of them, we haven't set the read-write-enable signals.
Oh, right. So the read-write-enable signals. So I didn't talk about it. I drew this write question mark here. And we do need to do that. Yes, that is very important. And this is part of me not drawing the control path, that I just casually omitted that very important thing, which you definitely need to get right, or else your processor will do very weird stuff. Like writing for an add instruction to memory. So on. Anything else? So ignoring this picture, what does the call instruction do? Who can tell me about that? Just what does call do on x86? Yeah. Okay, so it puts an address of code onto the stack. And we can't do that with the instruction memory because we can't write. So this data in needs to be the address of the next instruction, which in fact is this address right here. So for call, we need to somehow get this value over into data in, which currently we can't do. Yeah.
With pop, we want to read the thing that was at where the stack pointer was, and we've already decremented it, so the thing in val e is one too high.
Yeah, so for pop, we want to read from the current stack pointer and change it to a different value. So that we're computing the different value in our ALU because we don't have any other place to do it, but we need to take that value and shortcut it over to the address. And that also occurs. So we have those two exceptions. So we have, we end up with something like this, and also wiring up that ALU input would be great. Okay. So then we have our write back stage where we actually write registers. So let's, so we need to set the destination register numbers and also their values. We learned that the textbook uses the M port for values that come from memory and the E port for values that come from the ALU. So let's just wire it up that way. Where did I mess up? This is following that convention, E for ALU results, M for memory results. And it turns out that generally we have our M is going to be equal to our A, and our E is going to be equal to our B. But where are we in trouble here? Where did I make a mistake? Again, there are some instructions we can't do. In fact, all of these instructions won't work with this wiring. Every single one of them. So what's the problem?
We haven't set the destination as F ever.
Okay, we haven't ever set disabled writing to registers. We're always writing to two registers. So for a NOP, we don't want to change any registers. And whatever's in RA and RB, well, it's probably not 0, unless we're really lucky. Probably not F, 15, unless we're really lucky. So we'll probably change a register's value, and we're going to change them to whatever comes out of the memory. It's probably not the same as the old value. So we're probably in trouble. For IR move Q, we want to change only one register. Same thing for all the others, not two, which is what this is going to do. So we need to have some control over whether we write or not. So we're going to do something like this, where we have a MUX, where we either take a register number from the instruction or no register, maybe, and for the stack instructions, we might sometimes need to write RSP, like for push or pop, to change the stack pointer. Okay. So that's about the values to write, the register numbers to write to. There's another issue, which is that I said that we always write our either our memory outputs, so like for an RM move queue, or a pop, or our ALU output. And there's one instruction we're in a bit of trouble for that, and that's IR move queue. Like where for IR move queue, the value we want is in fact this value. So it seems like we should have like a shortcut to like be able to get that value in a MUX to handle that. Like what we saw when we did our move processor. And our textbook doesn't do this. They have a different choice, but this is a valid way of implementing it. Yes?
Could we just toss it into the ALU and add 0 to it?
Yes, could we call it, so your option is let's toss it into the ALU and add 0 to it, and that's what our textbook does. So we would do something like this, you know, for this is for RR move Q, and this is for IR move Q. We would like, one thing you could do is you could take the value directly. What our textbook does instead, rather than having a direct path to take RA and send it into RB, and to take the media and send it into RB, like this, with a MUX controlling it, after the ALU, they have decided that they're going to add 0. Sometimes.
I mean, it's with fewer wires.
Yes, so you can see the justification that it's fewer wires, and that's why they did it. You do not have to do that. You are welcome to take this strategy, and it's a realistic thing because, well, the ALU is going to have to be there anyways. But either option is fine. So any questions on this?
Would there be like any performance advantage?
The question is, would there be any performance advantage? So we'll talk probably next time a little bit about what the performance is. And the big question is, can we make our cycle time lower? And probably not. But like it depends on like how the MUXes work exactly electrically and so on. Okay. And our final step is to update the program counter. Update PC. So usually it's valp. We have two other cases, or three other instruction cases. So we have call and conditional jump. So in those cases, sometimes it's the immediate from the instruction, which we call valc. And we have return, where we read it from the stack, so it comes from memory. So we end up with something that looks like this, where we have this choice right here. Okay, questions? Here. Okay, so that's our PC update. So that's our entire processor, roughly as our textbook does it. And as I pointed, except maybe missing a few details, so we see how to do that. So here's processor, one possible wiring. I may have some MUX inputs that aren't needed. So let's say we're doing add R8 or 9. We have a bunch of MUXes on this picture. I've named them by like what signal they control. What should they be set to? So I would go through, figure out what all these should be for add. Add R8 or 9. I'll give you a minute to look at that.
Yeah. I just want to answer the question.
Yeah.
When we update the PC, we usually add something to it, but that's not happening in our AOU. So how else that happens?
In this picture, the question is, how is the PC updated if their ALU isn't doing it? In this picture, I have a separate adder, and it's not part of the ALU to do that. And this is a common strategy in real processors, because especially if you want to do one instruction per cycle, you basically have to have another adder to do that. Who wants a bit more time? Okay, so let's go through this systematically. So we think about this stage by stage. In our first stage, we're going to take our PC, we're going to read that value, we're going to get our A and our B, and we want to read both of the register numbers from the instruction. And we come across our first mux, where we could read from RSP or RB. We probably want RB, because otherwise we can't figure out read from R9. So we're going to end up, and I have this all labeled out here, we're going to end up reading from R9. So I'll draw on this to be more clear. So we have our top connection going down to send R9 into source B. Then we want to take R8, and we want to add that with R9. So R8 is here, R9 is here. We want them to go through to the ALU. So we select those values for those muxes. Then I have my data memory. And I know that I'm not going to be writing and I'm not going to be reading. So I don't actually care what happens here and here. Like, they could do anything, it's not going to have an effect because I know I'm going to have read enable and write enable not set. Then I have my ALU result, which is on this wire, which I know I'm going to get into the, I probably should highlight it clearly, into a register. So this is R-E. So this controls where it goes. Fortunately, I can put RB into that. If I couldn't, I would have a problem. So I want to set RB, which is 9, as the input to DEST-E. Finally, I need to have my PC update. I want to go on to the following instruction, which is this BALP, remember, PC plus 2. So I want to send that through as my PC input, so during the next cycle, we'll execute the instruction 2 bytes after this one. So any questions on what I've done here? Yeah?
Why is it PC plus 2 twice, like up on the top end?
So the question is, why is this PC plus 2 here? So this is memory at PC plus 2. This is the immediate.
Oh, gotcha.
That doesn't exist in our instruction, but it's from the place where it would be.
Okay,
other questions? Okay, so finish up with right, and I have my answers. So we start on this in our last minute. Do the same thing for RM move queue, which, if it helps, is move queue, RA into DRB. That's where I'll finish off. You can work on this on your own. The thing to verify where you can go through it is, like I labeled here, you can label every where everything is, what the values are for a specific example, and work it out.